We've got some real science tonight with Alan Boss, author of The Crowded Universe, and your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Alan, some of the pictures I've seen from Hubble looks like some of the areas of the galaxy are alive. It looks like planets are forming or systems are forming in pods almost, doesn't it?
Yes, planets tend to form where stars are forming, and stars form in large clusters typically. Some of the most massive regions of star formation are where most stars form. That's probably a sort of region where our own solar system formed, around with maybe another 100,000 or 100 or 10, even a million stars.
What seems to keep the physics the same? Why are these laws all happening throughout the universe? I don't see anything deviating.
That's right. There's, from the basic physics point of view, if you have a law which has been tested and proven here on Earth, there's no reason, to, at least based on what we know so far, to think that that law varies elsewhere.
All right, let's go to some of the calls. Let's go to Sebring, Florida. John on the wild card line. Hey, John. How are you?
Thanks. Wonderful. Wonderful to be on your program. It's so interesting tonight.
Sure.
I listen often. I want to ask Mr. Voss make three comments and ask a question with each comment. The weatherman here from Tampa showed us how to look in the sky tonight and see the space station going over. It was going so fast. It was magnificent to see clear sky here. I'm wondering about how high it is and how fast it was moving. We only could see it about 8 or 9 minutes. And then the other question, a man I heard give a talk recently said our Earth is part of a solar system, part of a galaxy, and he said there are billions of galaxies. That's a very magnificent statement. And what does Mr. Voss think of that? And a third thing, I read an explanation of how they determined the speed of light, how they measured it for the first time. It had something to do with Paris, France. And I just want to get off the phone and listen to the gentleman explain all this. It's a wonderful show. Thank you so much.
Okay, you take the last one first if you want, then we'll get to galaxies and the ISS.
Yeah, I think that's the Fizeau experiment on Paris, France, where they bounced light back and forth off of some mirrors, including a rotating mirror, which had several faces, and they were trying to, because the speed of light is so fast, and this when it was done back in, I think, the 1800s, methods for measuring time were not as precise as we have these days, and so they were bouncing mirror light off of mirrors back and forth across the distance of, I think, several miles, I think involving the Paris Observatory, if I'm right, and by synchronizing their mirror speed, they could check to see when they got a reflection back over a distance of many times a mile, and then they, with their precision they had available at the time, they could get an estimate of the speed of light that way. So at the time, it was quite a tour de force of an experiment.
I know that Hubble, when it took a picture, a small pinpointed-looking area of darkness revealed, and you couldn't see anything with your eyes, revealed thousands of galaxies just in a little spot.
Exactly. There were two experiments that Hubble did. First one was called the Hubble Deep Field, then they did the Ultra Deep Field, which is even a longer exposure, where they basically put together, in the case of the Hubble Deep Field, I think it was the equivalent of basically 6 days continuously of staring at the same portion of the sky. And what you see is that for basically every star in our galaxy, of which there are on the order of 100 billion or so, give or take a few billion, for every one of those stars in our galaxy, there are even more galaxies distant beyond it. So basically, that's how you get the estimate. There are probably another 100 billion galaxies in the universe that we can see, because for every star in our galaxy, you can see another galaxy in something like the Hubble Deep Field. So you take 100 billion stars in our galaxy, multiply by another 100 billion, you're up to an awful lot of stars in the universe.
And the International Space Station, that's up about 250 miles, I believe.
Right. It orbits around the Earth about every 90 minutes thereabouts, so what's called a low Earth orbit. And I don't have the numbers exactly at hand, but the speeds, I think, are on the order of 10 to 20,000 miles per hour. That's roughly, I think, orbital speed, something of that order. So it's really hauling itself across the sky rather rapidly.
At that height, Alan, 250 miles, do they have to boost it at all every once in a while?
Yes, indeed. In fact, there was just an incident about a week or so ago, or maybe January 14th, I think, they did a little boost on the space station, and they unfortunately, something went wrong. I think the Russian Moscow controllers had sent up an incorrect sequence of commands, which resulted in the whole space station vibrating much more than it's supposed to vibrate, which is a little bit scary for the astronauts on board. But hopefully they'll fix that command sequence and get it right. So they do boosts, I believe, both by the space station itself has some, I guess, rocketry built into it. But primarily, I think it's done by when the shuttle goes up and uses its engine to boost it back up. Because even at that altitude of 250 miles or so, there's still a little bit of Earth's atmosphere up there, which produces drag. And given enough time, that gas drag from the Earth's atmosphere will pull it back down eventually into the ocean or onto the one of the continents.
Next up, let's go to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, east of the Rockies. Hello, Harry. You're up with us on Coast to Coast.
Yes. Alan, we wouldn't be here today if a big rock hadn't struck our planet 65 million years ago and killed all the dinosaurs. Now, how do we know that the planet that you're searching for doesn't still have dinosaurs roaming the planet?
It might very well have dinosaurs. We'd be happy to find that out. That would be more. What could be more exciting than finding a Jurassic Park on another nearby planet?
Sure.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure you've read Peter Ward's Rare Earth.
Yeah, I'm aware of the book. Yes, and Don Brownlee was a co-author.
Yeah. Well, in it, he states that the chances of finding another planet with intelligent life like ours is a gazillion to one. And I happen to agree with him. And even if we did, contacting them or communicating with them would be nigh on to impossible. And as far as traveling to that planet, it would be even more astronomical.
I agree. Those are all pretty pretty stiff problems. And so that's why I think the real scientific goal of what NASA hopes to do in the next couple of years is to find a nearby planet which has some sort of perhaps microbial life on it. We're not trying to find advanced intelligence and civilizations, much less travel to them. We're just trying to find, through remote observation, through comparative planetology, we're trying to find other worlds which could have evidence for some sort of at least primitive life form. That's actually the easiest thing to find. It's the thing which you're most likely to find because that's the sort of life which has characterized Earth for most of its span of 4.5 billion years of existence. And so that's what we're going to go for. And I think we do have a good, very good case can be made that we can achieve that in the next 10 years or so.
Great time to be a scientist, is it not, Alan?
It is. I would actually, sometimes people call this the golden age of astronomy. I would think it's a bit more than that. It's more like the platinum age. I think, whatever, that's the 75th anniversary. So I think we moved beyond gold. We're in the platinum now because there's really much more glass up on in Earth orbit as well as on telescopes around the world that are searching the skies. There is much more known about astronomy now than has ever been known, and more astronomers are alive now, as you can imagine, than have ever been alive. Essentially, every astronomer ever lived is alive right now. The number who've died and helped us, that we're standing on their their shoulders, are trivial compared to the 5,000 or so astronomers just within the U.S. right now. So we are truly living in the platinum age of astronomy, and there's much more to come.
How old were you when you got your first telescope, Al?
I was probably about, 55 years old. I think I bought my first one 2 years ago.
Are you kidding me?
I'm a theorist. and also, I actually grew up in Florida on an island, Clearwater Beach, and the skies in Pinellas County are often quite brightly lit at night. And
you can't see
the
stars.
Clouds. If you can see the sun and the moon, you're doing pretty well, by and large, was my experience.
I would have thought you would have been a little boy genius with the telescopes and... You were just all over the place.
No, I grew up reading the Encyclopedia Britannica. That's what got me interested in science and learning. That's what was my way to understand the world. And I was actually, since I grew up on an island, I was planning on becoming an oceanographer. My sister was going to be a marine biologist. She went to graduate school at UC San Diego, became a cell biologist. I went to UC Santa Barbara, ended up becoming a physicist.
Next up, let's go to Portland, Oregon, west of the Rockies. Hi, Paul, you're on with us.
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen.
Sure thing.
Nice show, George. Say, Alan, we know that Sirius and Poseidon have white dwarfs as their companion stars.
Yes.
What's the possibility of either of those reaching a Chandeskar's limit, which would put them into supernova, and could our sun have had a a companion star and been a survivor of such an event?
Well, once you become a white dwarf, that's pretty much it. You're not going to be gaining any more mass. It will put you over the Chandrasekhar limit and force you to become a neutron star. So unless you, I mean, there are some systems where there is mass accretion going on between the two, and that can lead, it has to be a very close system so that mass can flow from the more massive, larger star onto the white dwarf. And I think that is a type of supernova formation. But I'm not sure. I think the separation of the Sirius white dwarf was imaged, and so that white dwarf has to be considerably far away from Sirius, so that's not in danger of having any mass transfer onto it and having it undergo a supernova event. In the case of our solar system, there actually was one fellow who claimed that the sun might be the leftover remnant of a supernova. Professor at University of Missouri, Oliver Emanuel, claimed that perhaps the sun was what was left behind. And he based that on basically looking at the amount of iron in the Earth versus Venus versus what he hypothesized was for Mercury, sort of drawing a line saying that, well, gee, things are getting denser and denser as you go to the center of the solar system, so therefore the sun may be perhaps the iron-rich core of a supernova. Well, that idea has been tossed out, but pretty much not really picked up by anyone else, because there would be other consequences, needless to say, if the sun had been a supernova that are not explainable based on what we know about the sun. We know very much what the solar interior is like because we can study the sun's oscillations through solar seismology. And the interior of the sun is definitely not what you'd expect for the remnants of a supernova core.
Oh, also, are they concentrating on the F, G, and K-class dwarf stars on the main sequence?
In the searches for extrasolar planets, yes. Basically, F, G, and K, and a few of the M dwarfs as well. The radial velocity folks were the ones who are ruling the roost. They found something like 300-odd planets so far. They basically go up to the early M dwarfs, so-called M4 or so, because beyond M4, the stars get so faint that they just don't have enough photons for the radial velocity folks to find a Doppler wobble in a reasonable amount of time. On the other hand, other folks are planning on trying to search the red dwarf stars, the stars which are later and lower mass than the M4 stars with masses of maybe 30% the mass of the sun or less. And those stars also give off most of their light in the red portion of the spectrum. And so the folks who have spectrometers set up to work more in the visible portion of the spectrum really have a hard time working in very red stars. And so folks at various places are trying to figure out ways to search the lower mass M dwarf stars for planets as well, because they're probably going to have planets as well as the slightly more massive stars.
What do you think of the possibilities that we're in a binary star system in the solar system?
That's been hypothesized for many years as a possible explanation for periodic comet showers. It might been associated with things like the KT impact 65 million years ago and other periodic extinctions in the record. These days, however, those events of periodic comet showers are perhaps more easily explained in terms of galactic tides, that is the overall gravitational pull of the rest of the galaxy on us and disturbing the so-called Oort cloud of comets which envelops the sun, sending comets our ways. It would be wonderful if we could find evidence for another binary companion to us, but it's sort of like looking for another planet in the outer solar system. People have looked for it, but we probably would have seen it by now because, after all, we pretty much have a good census of everything that's in our solar neighborhood. We pretty much know what's there within, say, out to 60 light years. That's a fairly complete census. The only thing we might be missing are some really low-mass stars, so-called L and T dwarf stars with which are really closer to being brown dwarfs rather than regular main sequence stars, which are burning hydrogen. And if such a star existed with a fair amount of mass so that it could burn hydrogen, we would have seen it a long time ago. So if there's any other companion out there, it has to be very small, very low in mass, and very dark.
Let's go to John driving around in Tennessee on our first-time caller line. John, you're on with Alan Boss.
Yes, I have a two-part question.
Sure.
First part is, do we understand why all the planets revolve in the same direction around our sun, and do we know whether or not the same situation exists in other planetary systems?
Excellent questions. In the case of our solar system, the reason that the planets all revolve around the sun in the same direction is that the planets formed out of a rotating disk of gas and dust called the solar nebula in our case, or protoplanetary disks in the case of other stars, and we actually can measure these disks now. Astronomers can go out and look at young stars and look at the take images of the disks of gas dust around them, and in many cases they can actually measure the rotation of those disks and show that they are indeed rotating just like Kepler's laws would predict them. They're in Kepler in rotation around their stars. And so, and that just simply comes out of the fact that when the star formed in the first place, it formed from the collapse of a rather diffuse cloud of gas and dust, and if it had just a small amount of initial rotation, by the time that cloud of gas and dust collapsed down to a very tiny size compared to where it started, it will have spun up so rapidly, just like a figure skater spins up rapidly when he or she pulls his arms in while doing a spin. And that spin produces a disk of gas and dust which has so much angular momentum that it cannot end up accreting onto the star to form the star. It's left behind to form the planetary system, and it's all rotating in one direction. So that makes perfect sense. And so given that we know that's what happened for our solar system and that we can see observations of other young stars with similar disks, we expect that to be the case for other extrasolar planetary systems. We can't really, in most cases, directly detect the other planets' motions and show that they all have to be in the same direction. In some cases, we can. There are actually some systems where we know of at least four or five planets in the system, but the working assumption for any astronomer trying to fit the data is that, yes, they are indeed orbiting in the same direction. There may be some variations as to whether or not they're all in the same plane or not. They may be inclined to each other a bit, but basically everyone assumes that these things are orbiting the same direction.
What in your opinion, are black holes?
Black holes are regions of space-time which are so condensed that no light can get out except for quantum processes that folks like Jim Hartle and Stephen Hawking talked about 30-odd years ago. They are regions which have condensed under their own gravity and are singularities, you might say, where nothing can really exist. It's an infinitely dense region of space with a finite radius.
If you were to survive going into one, what would you come out to?
Wow, now we're really getting speculative. Yeah. Of course, in the process, we were joking before about going through wormholes. One of the problems with going through wormholes is that if you do a theoretical calculation of what happened to you, you basically get stretched into something much closer to that python we were talking about earlier.
Exactly.
On. It'd be very long and skinny, but to such an extent that you would be hard-pressed to remain as a functioning human being. So you'd have the same process on the way back out again, so I don't think you would be likely to be alive. To go beyond that becomes very quickly the realm of science fiction and wonderful movies rather than speculation that I'm able to dabble in.
But there's got to be something in there, right? I mean, if you go into it somehow.
Yes, there's mass and energy, and unfortunately it's a singularity. It means it is infinite, which makes it rather hard to describe with any sort of physics.
How bizarre. Absolutely. And I guess if you were going into it, Alan, as you were going into it, what would you see, let's say, on the sides of it? Anything? Would you still
on the sides of it, if you're coming in.
If you're going into this hole, this black hole, right, and you're into it to a point, how my mind is trying to figure this out.
Presumably there would be other matter. The black holes are often surrounded by things called accretion disks, which is the material, again, which has spin on the same sort of disks in a sense that form planetary systems around stars. Black holes often have accretion disks around them, which are quite hot because there's this material which is falling onto the black hole, and it's very deep in the potential well of the black hole, so that it has very high velocities even as it's spinning around, which makes it very hot. So you probably would be blinded by very high temperature radiation, very high temperature gas, a plasma with radiation. It would be a very blinding experience. Would be the last thing you would see before everything went black. If presuming you could last that long.
We'll be back with final phone calls with you, Alan Boss, in a moment. Then next hour, Joshua P. Warren joins us with some paranormal stories. Well, how would you like to pick up past programs, do some podcasting, and always have parts of Coast to Coast with you at all times? Just go to coasttocoastam.com, and you can sign up for pennies a day for what we call Streamlink. Let's go to final calls now with Alan Boss, driving around in North Carolina. Robert, thanks for holding so long. You're on Coast to Coast.
Oh, great. Hey, hopefully I can hold on long enough to get my question answered.
Okay.
I've been fascinated as I drive along. Sometimes I look out in a clear night without a lot of lights, and I see all the stars, thousands of stars. I just wonder, the ones that we can see with our naked eye, how close are they in relation to all the stars in the sky? And the reason why I ask that question is because they all look pretty much the same light. They give off that. Amazing to me that a star.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. Listen on your radio, Robert. There are different magnitudes of the stars, Alan, but good question. What are the distances from what we're looking at?
Most of them are in what I would call the sun's neighborhood of the galaxy. They're pretty close by. And so they're all within, I would say, typically on the order of a few hundred light years away, whereas our entire galaxy is more on the order of a few hundred thousand light years across. So
you're pretty much
looking around your same block in a big city.
One light year being 6 trillion miles, right?
Right. The distance that light travels in 1 year, which is a pretty fair distance.
Sure is. It's a big universe, isn't it?
It is. If you ever get a chance to go to a really dark site, like out west in West Texas or in the Atacama Desert of Chile, and you look up at night, you can, of course, also see the Milky Way galaxy more or less edge on because we're embedded in the galaxy. And that really gives you a much different feeling for what's going on. Instead of just seeing the few stars that are around us, you get a sense for the entire galaxy. And if, in addition, you're in the south, you can see the large and small Magellanic clouds, which orbit sort of above the plane of our galaxy. If you look at those two clouds as well as the Milky Way, you can get a real feeling for, in a three-dimensional sense, what is going on in our galaxy, which is a tremendous opening of the mind, if there ever was one, is to, if you ever get a chance to go south and stand in a dark sky, get a feeling for what the universe is like on the scale of our galaxy and its neighbors. You can see it with your own eye and feel it.
Matt in Chicago, you're up with us. Hey, Matt.
Hi, George.
Yeah.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure thing.
Dr. Voss?
Yes.
Something, you know, I've listened to George for a number of years and Art before that, and with the questions about, you know, life in the universe or even in our own galaxy, and I don't mean to drag it back to what one of the other previous callers was talking about, but as we look back in time, which is what I think we agree on, that when you look through a telescope, that's what you're doing. You're seeing stars. There's no direction in space. What life could there be that we are only seeing the light now? So if somebody's waving to us from, you know, 2,000 light years away, is there a point in space where life could be like us and not be a something like a phantom?
Sure, sure. That's a good point. The stars that we're going to be searching for life are pretty much in the solar neighborhood, so they're only a few hundreds of light years away. So their difference in time is, as you could expect, just a few hundred years. So the light that we see coming from them is a hundred or few hundred years old. But on the time scale of which human beings live, which is on the order of 100,000 of years or so, and on the time scale of which life evolved on our planet, which has been around for perhaps 3 or 4 billion years, that 100 years, of course, is just a tiny sliver of time. So from the point of view of actually having a conversation with them, a 100-year gap would be kind of big for a slow text messaging. But from the point of view of looking to see if there are other habitable planets that are more or less alive right now, 100 years is trivial. That's essentially, that is still right now, at this instant in time. Right. If we were trying to look for other galaxies with higher redshifts, which are literally getting our light from them billions of years ago, that, of course, is a whole nother question. But we're not at the point of trying to look for life in other galaxies. We're just trying to find it right here in the solar neighborhood.
Alan, in your career, what's the one thing you'd like to see accomplished beyond any shadow of a doubt?
I would like to have us actually launch a space telescope, which will be able to take a picture of a Earth-like planet around a nearby star. I think that is the major goal that NASA should be going after. Is an achievable goal. The Jet Propulsion Laboratory has been making designs for building such a space telescope for many years. They know how to do it. The Europeans want to work with us on doing the same sort of thing. It will just take, unfortunately, a few billion dollars to do it. But on the scale of the economic recovery plan these days, that is nothing.
Would we ever be able to develop a telescope where we might not be able to travel the 10 or 20 or 30 million light years away, all right? We may not be able to do that, but we would be able to see it through this massive kind of telescope to the point where you might be able to make out trees or vegetation.
Trees and vegetation would be a little bit tough in terms of, you know, individual trees, of course, but what we can find is the spectral signature of vegetation. For example, on our Earth, there's something called the red edge around 7,000 angstroms of light, where if you look at the spectrum of our planet, the amount of light being absorbed by all the trees on the planet and the vegetation changes the spectrum of our planet dramatically. So if we had enough spectral resolution on an Earth-like planet, we could actually tell that planet probably has a lot of chlorophyll plants all over its surface. That is something that could be done with a large enough telescope up in space.
Okay, next up, let's go to Oregon. Don. Hi, Don.
Hi, guys.
Yeah.
George, my 5-year-old golden retriever is going to need a boyfriend in about 7 months. I don't know what yours is, but let me know. I want to keep him in the coast-to-coast family.
Well, you know, she's a yellow lab.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Well, anyway, other than that, Alan, I want to know what you thought about... I've heard all these scientists talking about the universe expanding so rapidly that at some point in time, all the stars are going to go out and we'll just be in a deep freeze. And I'll listen off the air. And thanks again, George.
Okay, Don. All right, Alan.
That is something we don't have to worry about for a long, long time. I mean, we're talking about timescales of, I believe, hundreds of billions of years. So it's more of a theoretical nicety. It's something which is kind of fun to think about what the ultimate fate of the universe will be. But in terms of human existence, of course, it has absolutely no impact on our lives.
At all.
At all.
Next up, Littleton, Colorado, west of the Rockies. Glenn, you're on with astronomy. Should I call you doctor? Do you have a PhD?
Indeed, I do, in physics.
All right, good. Dr. Alan Boss, go ahead.
Dr. Boss, can you explain to me how the Earth's orbital velocity got so well tuned to its orbital radius that we don't go spinning out into space away from the sun, or don't go spinning into the sun?
Sure. That is a part of the process of how the planetary system formed. If the Earth was spinning, orbiting around the sun too slowly, basically, if we suddenly something slowed us down, our orbit would change and we would head in towards the sun. Our orbit would become more elliptical, basically. With the sun still as the center of mass of the system as the focus of the ellipse, but we would come in closer to the sun and then come right back out to where we are right now and then fall back into the sun again. On the other hand, if we were suddenly sped up in our orbit, given an extra amount of angular momentum around the sun, we would again go on an elliptical orbit where our present position would be the closest distance to the sun, but our farthest distance would be considerably larger. And so some planets do have more eccentric orbits than what we have. Our Earth's orbit is fairly circular in terms of eccentricity. Orbital eccentricity is about 0.02. Jupiter's is a little bit more eccentric. It's about 0.05. You can imagine, though, planets having eccentricities that are 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, and so on, which would be doing, as you say, getting farther or closer from their star in their orbits. But we believe that in the case of our solar system, the planetary formation process in this disk managed to damp out these non-circular orbits and basically force everything to be roughly circular. And that was what we thought would be the case for extrasolar planetary systems as well, but we are actually quite surprised when we found that actually looking at other nearby systems that a lot of the gas giants we've seen so far actually are in highly eccentric orbits. A lot of them are, in a sense, moving too fast or too slow for the distance from the sun. And we're still trying to understand how that came to be, because our solar system does not look like that, but many of the gas giants found so far are in highly eccentric orbits.
Astrophysicist Duncan Foreman says that he believes it will take 300 to 400 years to make contact with neighbors. What do you think? 300 to 400 years? Sounds like a long time.
It sounds like a long time. If it happened that rapidly, I think that would be a tremendous success. Because I think one of the big questions we have is how many terrestrial civilizations or advanced civilizations there are in the galaxy and whether or not they are radio communicative right now. I mean, presumably he's saying that we're expecting to get perhaps a radio signal from somebody or some other signal, perhaps optical flashes. People are also talking about having optical visible light being used to signal between civilizations.
Like the old days.
yes.
You know?
Indeed. Other ideas have been advanced from long ago of how to communicate. It's been an idea that's been around for quite some time, so it's quite a history. So if we actually manage to find another civilization in 300, 400 years, I would say that that would be fantastic. I hope we can find one by then.
Let's go to Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hello, Derek. Go ahead.
Yes. I was wondering, with the Mars rovers finding and taking pictures of ice evaporating on this surface, would it be possible for us to take plant life to there to be able to provide oxygen for the planet for future, you know, humankind?
There have been serious ideas proposed for what's called terraforming Mars by many years. For example, Chris McKay out at NASA Ames Research Center and other folks there have talked about this, especially back in the 80s and 90s when folks like Carl Sagan were still alive and dreaming about such ideas. So there are serious plans about trying to convert Mars into a more habitable planet. It's not a simple task, as you can tell from just trying to understand how we can control the Earth's climate to keep it habitable for us to try to convert Mars into a habitable world is a much more severe task. But people have some serious ideas about doing it. But you can imagine it might be rather hard if you had to file the environmental impact statement for how to convert Mars into a habitable planet. Who knows if the Martian Congress will allow that one to go through.
Mm-hmm. See, I was just wondering because, you know, with as much carbon monoxide as they have, you know, plants may be able to, you know, thrive quite well there.
What people had in mind was actually trying to produce an oxygen atmosphere by doing several things, by melting ice caps and doing all sorts of stuff. So, yeah, planets, if you have a plant which is happy with, it's probably actually more carbon dioxide, I think, as input. And water, you can imagine having some sort of a hothouse on Mars. However, you know, the Mars atmosphere is pretty ethereal compared to the Earth's atmosphere. It's roughly 1% of Earth's atmosphere. So even though there is, you know, a bit of nitrogen and carbon dioxide and oxygen in the trace amounts in the atmosphere and trace amounts of methane, it's still a very, you know, compared to Earth's atmosphere, it's what we almost would call a vacuum. You would not be able to breathe there on your own. So I think plants would have a hard time thriving unless you had them in a hothouse with an atmosphere of its own.
Alan, are you in agreement that we need to send mankind to Mars?
I think it's a wonderful idea. It certainly is the next step beyond the moon. Going back to the moon pure and simply for the moon's sake is interesting, but using the moon as a stepping stone to go on to Mars, to my mind, is a long-term goal for NASA, is a suitably ambitious project. You know, back in 2004, George Bush proposed his vision for space exploration, yeah, which included the going onto the moon and onto Mars, and I thought that was a wonderful vision because it also included as a footnote that we should also build advanced telescopes in Earth orbit to look for other planets, which the planet hunters like me just applauded greatly. The only problem was that while the vision was there, there was unfortunately no money to support much of the vision beyond completing the space station and returning the shuttle to flight. So that is the problem of where to find the funds to do it. And, of course, in this current economic environment, it's even harder to imagine NASA getting more money. And the stimulus package that President Obama has up for consideration by Congress right now, both the House and the Senate have only rather minor increases in the vision for NASA, and most of those increases are geared towards Earth science, trying to understand more about climate change. They're not geared towards returning to the moon or Mars. So I think it's probably going to take a while for this economic crisis to pass before people can get serious about perhaps thinking more about achieving something like what President Bush had proposed. And maybe at some point President Obama will put forward his own vision for space exploration, and I will look forward to reading that document.
Why did Mr. Bush even propose it and never accomplish it or even attempt to?
Well, I think in large part he wanted to finish some work which had been left undone by his father, the first President Bush, who had proposed back around 1990 or so sending a man to Mars. It was estimated to be like a $400 billion program, which Congress choked upon, so that idea died immediately. And so I think George Herbert Walker Bush wanted to improve upon some of the things that his father left undone, and one of them was sending man back to Mars. The problem was that the budgets are, you know, just were not there. NASA has enough problems trying to keep the shuttle running and building the new Ares crew vehicle, that without a major increase in its budget, it just has more on its plate than it could do. And the Bush administration, at least, was unwilling to give NASA enough money to do what it asked to do. It's sort of an unfunded mandate. You shall do this, but we're not going to give you the resources to do it with.
Okay, let's go to Claire, Tallahassee, Florida. Go ahead, Claire.
Hi, honored to talk to you both.
Thanks.
I'm wondering what you think about a more universal question. In the universe, where scientists have this theory about the fragmental theory, where things are just a copy and a copy and a copy and a copy, and it just keeps going on throughout the universe, of the universal theory of fragmentals. What you think about that?
I'm not terribly familiar with that, but certainly we expect that our local area of the galaxy, or of the universe, is not particularly different from any other segment of the galaxy. So if you can think of it from a theorist's point of view, it's like imagining repeating boundary conditions that whatever we're like here, if we could just pick ourselves up and transport ourselves halfway across the universe, we should still end up with a galaxy and a set of planets and stars that look more or less like our own, assuming that we're at the same age of the universe. So from that point of view, I think probably the basic intuitive feeling behind the fragmentary hypothesis makes a lot of sense.
Okay, let's grab one or two more, and we're done. Well, first of all, let me ask you, where do you get the book, The Crowded Universe? My gosh.
Well, presumably it's available in bookstores. It was just released this week on Tuesday of this week, so hopefully it's in your bookstores by now. But if you don't go there, you can certainly find it on Amazon.com.
Let's go to Dan in Indiana, east of the Rockies. We'll squeeze you in, Daniel.
Hi, yeah, good morning. Basically just have a silly kind of, I guess, theoretical question for you. As we find out more about quantum physics, we find out that solid objects are actually largely empty space. So theoretically, what's the possibility that as we're looking out, we're also kind of looking in?
Looking out and looking in.
I'm not sure if I can answer that one, but certainly as we're looking out into the galaxy, again, it's a case where most everything is empty space. The volume that's occupied by stars and planets is almost infinitesimally small compared to the distances between stars. You know, the sun has a radius which is 1/200th the distance of the Earth from the sun, and a typical star is another 200,000 times farther away. So the typical amount of space that's occupied on the scale of stars is like 1 part in 200 times 200,000 to the third power, which is a large number. It's a very small fraction. Let's see, that's about 10 to the 5th, 10 to the 7th. That's about 10 to the 1 part in 10 to the 21 is being occupied. So I think that's probably comparable to the vacuousness of an atom.
Right or wrong, knocking Pluto out of the planetary system?
I think it was the right thing to do. We now know that Pluto is just one of a whole swarm of objects out there that no longer should be considered a planet, in the same way that Ceres is no longer considered a planet once they found Vesta and Pallas and the hundreds of thousands of other asteroids. Pluto is the same situation, one of a cast of thousands.
Alan, thank you so much for being on the program.
You're welcome, George. Thank you for having me.
It's called The Crowded Universe by Dr. Alan Boss. When we come right back, Joshua P. Warren, Paranormal Stuff on Coast to Coast AM.